listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome to the Tom Hartmann Program. It is media for everybody. I'm Mike Papantonio, sitting in for Tom Hartmann this first hour. Coming up on this hour, John Nichols from The Nation is going to tell us why Harry Reid's become one of the loudest voices against TPP. Thank you, Harry. And we'll be taking your calls live. I've got Aaron Cousins with me. We're going to be talking about the news in general. President Obama is still pushing for a fast track for TPP partnership. He's now facing opposition from unlikely sources. You're talking to somebody who's been very critical of Harry Reid in the past for not having the guts to stand up when he needs to stand up. We're seeing just the opposite from Harry Reid in the last couple of months. Very, very good development. Joining me now to talk about Reid's fight is John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine and a dear friend for a long time. John, let me ask you, we have to be proud of Harry. I mean, come on, this is the kind of Harry Reid we've wanted to see for a long time, isn't it?
You're exactly right. I thought you were going to use another word than guts when you were describing.
Yeah, well, I
heard you do your radio pause.
I keep myself in check. Anyway, go ahead. What do you give me your take on this?
I mean, this is a very big deal. President Obama last week, week or so ago, went out, did his State of the Union address. It was generally a good address. I mean, he's talking about income inequality and wages, coming back on manufacturing. Then he had this lead weight in the middle of the speech.
I caught it.
Oh, yeah. We got to do, you know, the trade promotion, got to do Trans-Pacific Partnership, this whole thing. And everybody across America is like, oh, no. You know, Here you're finally getting exactly where we want you on a winning message, and then you drop this thing in there.
Okay, so here's where we are. Here's where we are. He knows he's pushing against the wind. He's got Wall Street interest. He's got ALEC interest. He has all the big money people saying, yes, we want TPP, because you know and I know what it does is it creates a Saipan right here in America. I mean, think about this, John. You and I have talked about this before. Isn't it nice when you don't have to jump on an airplane and fly to Asia to where you get labor that has no rights, where you have labor that works for slave wages, to where you don't pay any benefits, to where you don't have any protection on the scene? Isn't it nice when you can do that right here in the United States? Because that's where TPP is taking us, isn't it?
That's exactly right. TPP is NAFTA on steroids. It's China's most favored nation trading status on steroids. It extends a broken model, a race to the bottom model, for trade policy to a whole host of new countries in Southern Asia especially, but also in South America. And it's just a rotten way to go forward. It's not logical. The people know this is wrong. And yet, the ball was rolling. And then this amazing thing happened. The president gave his speech, and the most important person for this president in Congress, the guy who really does decide whether things are going forward, and frankly, the guy who has kept Obama out of a lot of trouble, helped him in a lot of ways, even if you and I aren't always satisfied, steps up and says, look, as the leader of the U.S. Senate, I am telling you, first off, I am opposed to fast track. And he said it bluntly. He didn't say, oh, I got my problems with it. He says, I'm opposed. And then he says, and I don't think that it's smart to keep bringing this thing up right now.
Well, that's code talk for let's move on. And you have, of course, you have, you got Baucus. We know a guy like Baucus is going to come out. Democrat's going to say, Democrat Baucus is going to come out and say, you know, Max is always there for Wall Street. Max is one of them. So Max Baucus, who's getting ready to exit the chamber anyway, he's going to ambassador to China.
Yeah, I mean, if you can think of a more fitting endorsement.
Okay, but on the other side, you know, let's say good job. I mean, Bruce Braley, Tom Harkin, Elizabeth Warren, these heroes that were always, you know, I think one thing about you, and I think one thing about Tom and me, is we try to call it like it is. And we've been very critical of Democrats when they don't come through. This is a group of people that say, you know what, not only am I not going to support it, I'm going to be the voice against it. And Reid did that all the way back to NAFTA, didn't he, John?
This is the the thing. You know, if we had a media in this country that actually covered politics and paid attention rather than just kind of run so much of it through personality and, you know, pure kind of unadulterated partisanship, you would know that there's great, and I know you do know this, but everybody would know, there's great nuance within the Democratic Party on this issue. There have been people who for a very long time have had savvy doubts about the free trade approach that Presidents Clinton, Bush, and now Obama have pushed. Harry Reid's been in the midst of that. He voted against NAFTA. He voted against a number of these trade deals over the years. He's been a very steady hand in this fight. Doesn't make a lot of noise. He's not as outspoken as a Sherrod Brown, for instance, or a Bernie Sanders. But the critical thing is, I think this is where a place where we should understand the Senate as a unique chamber.
Yeah.
Harry Reid has always been against, and he would vote against, I think he'd vote against fast track no matter what. But that second part of the comment where he says, and I really don't think you ought to keep bringing this thing up right now. That was Harry Reid saying, I have talked to my members.
Yeah.
I've talked to the people who've gone to the mat for you, Mr. President, on health care, on a host of other issues, who've really taken some hard hits for you at times.
And they're not going to do it here. They're not going to do it here.
Right.
Yeah. You know what else says to me, John? It says, it's Harry Reid saying, you know what? I'm the guy. I'm the guy that travels around the country raising money for your campaign. So you probably shouldn't do this. There's a real nuance to the way that he's handled this whole thing. As we saw with the filibuster, it's like a new and improved Harry Reid, and I'm just so glad to be able to speak these words. Look, let me shift to something else. It used to have legislation, and you know I think you would have you'd certainly have policy issues, you'd have political issues, but then you would have conscience issues also. I don't know that conscience issues matter that much anymore, unfortunately, in Washington, D.C., but certainly policy issues and politics issues matter. What is this for Harry? Where is he falling on this?
It's a conscience issue for him. And,
good.
And, I never disagree with you, Pat, but sometimes I slightly correct. I think conscience issues exist very much in D.C.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I am glad to hear that.
I wish they did more, and I know you do. But the truth of the matter is, there are people like Sherrod Brown who would never vote for a bad trade deal. They just wouldn't do it. Sherrod's out of Mansfield, Ohio. He's seen the factories closed. Marcy Kaptur, she just wouldn't do it.
Now, Bruce Braley, Congressman Bruce Braley, a great example. This guy does have this. Braley's both a friend, and I followed his career a long time out of Iowa. He does care, doesn't he?
So these are the rock-solid ones. These are the ones you can count on. Now, what's interesting about it is he doesn't get covered this way, but Harry Reid's been one of the rock-solid guys for a long, long time. And people say, well, but there's not a lot of factories in Las Vegas. Well, this is a nuance that I write about in the piece for The Nation on this. People, one of the biggest lost realities of the debate over trade policy is that once upon a time, farm country, rural areas, tended to be pretty big backers of free trade, tended to, you know, be the first in line. Tom Harkin voted for NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a lot of these rural folks who were on board.
Well, they were sold a bill of goods. They really were.
That's right.
That's
what I'm saying about Harry Reid. Harry Reid is one of these people who has, over time, really come to understand the deep nuances of this debate.
Yeah.
To know that if Democrats are going to retain control of the Senate,
they can't do this.
John, get right on this.
John Nichols, thank you for joining me. Harry Reid on the right issue here. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Harkin. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Harkin Program.
John Nichols, always right on point with these issues, writes with The Nation magazine, agrees with me totally. Harry Reid's right on point with TPP. Keep it up, Harry. Farron Cousins, producer extraordinaire, what do you have lined up for Free Speech TV for the show we've got coming up this weekend? What do you have there?
We got a lot of really great things, you know. And one of the things before we get into it is we've been doing this for about a year now. We always try to just cover the issues that the corporate media either isn't covering or halfway covered. And I think we've done a really great job of that. And this week's show, again, another great example. We have this story about alternative labor groups, which there's been some written about them, but basically these alternative groups are taking over the roles that unions used to play before the, you know, Reagan Republicans came in and destroyed all the unions. And now they're taking up the mantle. They're fighting for workers' rights. And quite frankly, they have corporate America running scared. They're absolutely terrified because these groups are making pretty good headway.
Yeah, what we've tried to do on Ring of Fire, and we're going to have it this weekend, of course, we've learned from Tom Hartman and people like Tom Hartman and Ed Schultz, and that is to talk about issues that, you know, mainstream media just, God bless them, they just can't get right sometimes. And this is one of those issues. People don't even understand the impact of what alternative labor is having in the United States right now. Basically, you've had the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, ALEC, you've had all of the allied associated industries trying to deconstruct, actually make labor disappear. So now all of a sudden you have people like Walmart workers, fast food workers that are taken to the streets and they're saying, hell no, we're not going to work for that kind of money. And you know what? You better pay attention to us because we can shut your operation down. And that's what they did to Walmart on Black Friday, you remember? That's what they've done to McDonald's. And all of a sudden the Chamber of Commerce is saying, oh my gosh. We didn't count on all this. These people need to be handled just like organized labor. We need to put restrictions on them just like we did with organized labor. We need to have the labor board deciding when they can strike, how they can strike. But you know the bad news for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce? There is nothing at all written into the law that says a worker who's non-union, they absolutely have the right to work out, to walk out. They can walk out in droves. They can walk out in crowds. They can shut you down. So alternative labor is a big issue, isn't it?
It is. And let me tell you right now, on the current issue of Free Speech TV that's going to be airing until Saturday, I spoke with Ian Millhiser from Think Progress Justice, and we actually discussed the issue. There's a case in front of the Supreme Court right now. They heard arguments about a week ago, where they're debating on whether or not to take away the agency fees that organized labor collects on behalf of all right. the workers. And if they vote to take away these agency fees, then the unions will no longer be able to charge the non-union members for representation, for legal arbitration and things of that matter, which will effectively put an end almost to labor's ability to fight for workers. And this is a very important case that people need to pay attention to.
It's a big story. Also, on Ring of Fire this weekend on Free Speech TV, I'm going to have David Haynes. He's going to talk about political scandals surrounding the GOP heavyweights. Howard Nations is going to talk about the failure of citizens. The Democrats have failed to act on Citizens United and what it's costing them. Dr. Tom Snyder, brilliant physician, way, way ahead of the program, is going to be talking about dangers of dietary supplements. I'll be right back. Back to the Tom Hartman program. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom just this first hour. I have Gaius Publius from America Blog on the phone, a very, very smart man. It's always good to hear from you, Gaius. I've interviewed him several times. I'm always amazed at his insight. Gaius, go ahead.
Well, how are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Excellent. I have, as you know, been covering the Democrats from time to time, but the news out of Republican land is so striking these days that I had to sort of turn my attention back to that. I'm sure you're aware that the Koch brothers have reared their head even higher. You and I have talked about in the past that the Kochs were engineering a takeover of the Republican Party. It looks like in the last couple of weeks the evidence of that is actually rather clear because of that conference they've had at Palm Springs in the last week or so.
Yeah.
Some of the documents have leaked out of that, and they're sort of securing command and control of that party. They have several new Koch-funded organizations that will link them directly to parties, I'm sorry, to candidates, and also to the candidate education structures and candidate support structures.
Yeah, no, what's really remarkable, guys, to me is, and of course, we've been saying this for so long. Tom Hartman has been talking about, you know what, we talk about the Koch brothers almost like we're in a vacuum, but we don't really analyze what they're up to. Now, what they're up to, and these documents show, it's not just about the White House. They're not, you know, it's just not races about the White House. It's not the race about Congress or Senate. They're involved in races all the way down to the school board, all the way down to county commissioner, all the way down to city council. Why? Because that's where the money is. These guys only react to money. Now, ideology is part of it, obviously. But they understand if they get involved in county commissioner races in the very lowest level, those commissioners have impact in places. Can we frack here? Can we drill offshore? Can we build a new port for our oil? Can we have these are money issues for them, aren't they?
Money and power, and yes, money. If you look at I've been looking at the Koch brothers' wealth since writing about them recently. You've got estimates from about $72 billion to about $92 billion, and the latest one I've seen is over $100 billion, their combined wealth, out of their joint ownership or their 85% ownership of Koch Industries.
Yeah.
It's an amazing amount of money. I did a story recently about the pipeline, the Keystone XL pipeline. If that goes through, it's $100 billion of two Koch Industries, of which they will get 85%. They really are willing to burn us to the ground to be the richest people on the planet.
Yeah, well, there'll be no planet, but they'll have all the money. That's the idea. Gaius Publius, America blog. You always get it right. I recommend that blog to everybody. I always enjoy interviewing you. And thanks for calling in, okay? Let me go to Ed in Oregon. Ed, are you there?
Yes, I am.
How are you?
Doing fine. I've been listening to news on, about a month or two ago. I heard a story on, I think, Democracy Now! That a man was suing the police department because he discovered they were using IQ tests to rule out intelligent people, as well as using a Minnesota multiphasic to rule out anyone with empathy. They wouldn't let anyone with intelligence or empathy join the police department, which pretty much guarantees that you're going to have a bunch of Republicans on the police department.
Well, let me tell you, this story is – I saw edges of that story, and I've seen it before too. But you know what it really has to do with, Ed? It really has to do with we want somebody who will simply react rather than analyze, rather than – take the facts. What's really happening here? Do I really need to beat this man to the ground because he's homeless? Is he really a threat? Do I really need to pull out in Pensacola, for example, just last month, maybe a month and a half ago, police officers come up on a man near his car, and well, they think he's dealing drugs. He reaches into his car to actually get them proof that there's nothing wrong with it. They shoot the man. They unload 17 shells into his car, and then when all the smoke clears, the question comes down to: isn't there a routine that you should understand about how to deal with these issues? And unfortunately, when you talk to the experts about why it is that you have this reactive nature to these police officers, that's what they're trying to recruit. They're not trying to recruit people who can analyze and say, what's actually happening here? Is this guy really a threat? It is the Bruce Willis kind of notion. It is the Dirty Harry kind of notion that it is might always makes right rather than intelligence, reason making right. We're seeing it all over this country right now. The number of fatalities that come from police misconduct has never been higher. The only time we saw something like this was in the mid-60s. So they're getting exactly what they want, Ed. So there's really no, there's really no answer to it. What is your take on it? I mean, what do you think is happening?
The answer to this is that whenever you give a civil service examination, it's against the law to rule out another political party. And by limiting your police department to right-wing Republicans, no matter how you do it, you've broken the law. And it's a great class action lawsuit for all police departments across the United States.
Yeah, it would be a tough one, but I think what they can tell, a lot of people don't know what MMPI is, but you can tell an awful lot about what an MMPI is. For example, if you ever did a MMPI of Wall Street and you just randomly said, let's do a personality profile on the people who work at Goldman Sachs, you know, what we'd find out, I mean, you can tell a lot about it. You can tell, are they sociopath, which we would find there at Goldman Sachs, I can promise you. Do they have a tendency to fabricate the truth? We would find a lot of that. These tests are very accurate, especially in the right hands. The right technicians who are looking at MMPI can tell an awful lot about that character that's being analyzed. So, you know, I hear your point. I don't know that it has to do with trying to, you know, separate Republicans from Democrats, but what they are looking at is they're looking at the person who doesn't necessarily think, but is maybe willing to pull the trigger when it's really not necessary. That's what they're finding. And right now, because of that, these fatalities are really at an all-time high, and they continue to climb as we become the Bruce Willis police force. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm Mike Papantonio, and for Tom Hartman, give me a call at 866-987-8466 or follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Let me know what you're thinking. We'll be back.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mike Papantonio is still with us. Hey, Pap.
Tom, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for filling in for me for that first half hour.
It's always fun.
I so appreciate it. So what is at the top of your head right now? What's got you cranked?
Well, I'll tell you, I did a story this week for the radio segment of Ring of Fire. I just thought it was so interesting. And it is, we always, Tom, talk about this division of the Republican Party. I think you and I have been talking about this for 2 years, but now it's been turned up full tilt. And what we're seeing now is you have Karl Rove has created this Frankenstein monster. It's now unleashed. It's now moving about the country, in by way of people like Matt Bevin in Kentucky, who's running against Mitch McConnell. We're seeing race after race of really, I don't state this, this is a solid statement, wing nuts in their truth. It's like canned crazy has finally been freed. The freak show warm-up is now at full tilt. Clown cars are pulling up everywhere. And so right now, what's so funny to watch to me is that you've got guys like Tony Perkins, you know, with the Christian right, who is making this statement that now is our time. We have the greatest potential to have the greatest impact right now. Your religious liberties are being stolen from you. Americans are descending into a quagmire of self-destructive socialism run by the gay entities and every other awful thing, according to Tony Perkins, and that your religious liberty has been taken away. Now, what this is really about is you have the Koch brothers still at war. Okay, they've just changed. What they've done is they've slightly changed the narrative. Before it was just the tea. Remember, it was just the Tea Party. Now it is the Christian Tea Party, the Christian Tea Party right that is putting up these candidates. And I could not make up some of the stories about how crazy are they. Representative Frank Wolf. You've got a guy named Richard Black contesting the Republican primary to replace a guy named Frank Wolf in Virginia. Now, Black is the guy who says, I don't know how you could validly get a conviction of a husband and wife rape. It just is not right. Well, in other words, what he's doing is he's coming out and he's supporting the idea that it's okay for a
marital rape.
Yeah, it's just fine. And you've got these stories going forever. It's incredible material. You've got Chris McDaniel running against Thad Cochran, who's already a crazy right freak in every regard. He says one of his platforms are, you know, I'm going to change what Hollywood does if I'm elected, because right now there's a lack of Muslim. You don't think I'm making this up, but I'm not. There's a lack of Muslim villains in Hollywood films right now. Whoa. And we need to do something about it. But these stories, the edge of crazy has been fully open, Tom, and it's just out of control. And truthfully, McConnell can't do anything about it. Rove can't do anything about it. Fox News can't do anything about it.
It's coming out of these right-wing billionaires, principally the Koch brothers, who are funding this stuff. And I'm wondering, you know, what's the end game? It seems to me, Pap, that I mean, you look back on history, you go back to Russell Kirk in 1951. He wrote the book The Conservative Mind that mm-hmm. was the foundation for sure. Barry Goldwater and for Bill Buckley and all those guys. And he said in 51, if the middle class gets too large and too affluent, America is going to become destabilized, and that will be a destructive thing for American society. And in the 60s, as the middle class reached the peak of affluence in the history of the world, you saw women demanding rights, young people saying, hell no, I won't go to war, African Americans saying, hey, you know, it's our turn, you have the Civil Rights Act. By 71, you had the cities burning. In 69, you had Stonewall. Gays were saying, what about us? And everybody was smoking pot and taking acid, and the people on the right. Now, Thomas Jefferson would have loved this because he thought that change was a good thing. But conservatives historically think that change is a bad thing, and or at least it should be very, very slow and gradual and incremental. And so you had all these guys on the right say, holy cow, Russell Kirk was right. We've got to strip a lot of this wealth away from the middle class because these people have too much time on their hands and too much money. And they have succeeded. I mean, you know, they've thrown a third of what used to be the middle class into the working poor. They've thrown the students $1 trillion into debt when it used to be you could go to college for free or for damn close to it. You could work a part-time job through the summer and pay for your tuition. And it seems to me like the end game of this is to take us back to Dickens' England, you know, to a stable society where you've got
controllable stable society.
Exactly. My point. Yeah. Because that's the natural state of capitalism, actually, is Dickens' England. You know, a middle class is not a normal thing. Middle classes have to be created by government policy that represses or reduces the power of the super wealthy and enhances the power of working people relative to their employers. And if you don't do those things, a working class middle class will not emerge. The only kind of middle class that ever emerges is what you had during Dickens' time, which is a middle class of professionals, doctors and lawyers, and mercantilists, shop owners. That's it. Yeah. And Scrooge and Marley was a middle class guy. He was a small business owner who had two employees, himself and Bob Cratchit. And Bob Cratchit was the working poor. And I'm wondering, are the Koch brothers with this whole libertarian thing and this like, let's fuel the crazy on the right, are they really working toward that vision that Russell Kirk talked about in 1951 of let's literally destroy the American middle class so we can have a plutocracy, basically, and have a very healthy and stable country from the point of view of the very rich?
Yeah, I get that very well. Matter of fact, Richard Perlman, wrote the book on the Nixon years, if you recall.
Yeah.
I think you interviewed him one time. I believe I saw your interview with him. I know I did, and I was very impressed with his message. It's the same message you just delivered. If you think about it, what Nixon was able to do with his dirty tricks kind of guys, he was able to go out and he was able to scare the hell out of the American public into saying, look what's happening. People are in the streets over the war. People in the streets over drug use. Drug abuse is at an all-time high.
Women are burning their bras. People want abortions.
And so what he did is he had people like Segretti. You remember the name Segretti?
Oh, yeah, Donald Segretti.
Okay, so you had people like Segretti that were able to take that and mold it and actually create the mantra to where we've lost control. Now, let me jump now to 2014. This is the same thing. The Kochs are saying to this Christian right Tea Party, look, we have lost control. You have gays who now have rights that they've never had. You have a socialist president who is taking us to the edge, to the abyss.
And by the way, have you looked at the color of his skin?
Yeah. Yeah, by the way, he happens to be African-American, and that's scary. And so we're seeing a repeat of that. Perlman had, I think, said the same thing that you just laid out, and it is that this was repeating itself. This is simply a remake of what happened in Nixon Land, I believe was the name of the book.
Right.
But it was so well done. I was just absolutely so captivated by it. As a matter of fact, I'm inclined to go back and reread that book because it has such an impact for what we're seeing right here with people like Tony Perkins. Tony Perkins doesn't care about any of this stuff. Tony Perkins is a fraud. I mean, you know, in the truest sense, he's a fraud.
Same with Ralph Reed.
Of course. Yeah. But what now has happened is you have this alliance between the money guys. The Koch said, you remember we came out with Tea Party and it worked pretty well for us. Now we have to amp it up. It has to be the Christian right Tea Party. That's what it's become.
Right. Yeah. Part of that is let's put on a show so that they don't notice what we're doing with the tax code. They don't notice what we're doing with the international trade policy.
Yes.
They don't notice what we're doing with the courts. They don't notice what we're doing with products that kill people.
Right. You know,
it's like bread and circus.
Yeah. Well, for somebody to watch, I'm always amazed at how you hear the rank and file talk about the Taliban. Oh my God, they don't let women have any rights. They have to dress in an awful way. They don't have any liberties at all.
You can't dance.
This is the Taliban wingnut Christian right. That's what we're saying. And it's the reinvention of it, Tom. Now think about this. Think of how silent they have been for a while. Now the Christian right, they've been out there, but we haven't had a Tony Perkins out front saying, now is our time. Now is our time to reject conservative beltway Republicans because they're socialist too, because they're ungodly too, because they don't do enough about stopping abortion, because they voted in, they're all behind gay rights issues. Now is the time is the message, and now is the time is coming from the very people who invented these wingnuts to begin with. And we're just seeing it's just a new version of the Madison Project. Madison Project is out there. It's an awful it's just like the Senate Conservative Fund, which you're familiar with, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Those two organizations are putting huge money behind these races where, frankly, they have a very good chance to unseat Mitch McConnell with this guy Matt Bevin.
Yeah, it's the kind of right wing populism that we saw in the 20s and 30s in Spain, Germany, and Italy. Frankly, I realize how people recoil at anything that as soon as you mention Germany in the 30s, but it's right wing populism.
Yeah, I don't understand that recoil too, and because there's so much truth to it. It is that we had the mainstream media say, "Oh, you can't talk about that. How dare you use it?" But it's the truth. We're seeing some ugly things happen.
Yeah,
right here, right?
Mussolini invented the word fascism. It's a merger of state and business interests.
Yes.
And
yes.
So Mike Papantonio with us. We'll be back with more with Mike Papantonio here on the Tom Hartman program. 45 minutes past the hour, 15 minutes before the top of the hour, Stuart.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, we'll pick up some of your calls for Pap and for me, and if you have any thoughts on these topics. What do you think the end game is for the Koch brothers and the whole bunch of billionaires? Welcome back. Pap, you still with us?
I am.
I'm guessing that at the 15-minute break, you talked about what you've got coming up on Sunday on Free Speech TV, but I'd like to know. Do you mind just a quick recap?
Yeah, no, not at all. We've got... The something developing that it goes beyond the Christie. We're taking a different angle on the Christie material. The Christie material really is bigger. It is that what you have is a division right now that the average Republican has to decide, okay, I have a party here, that the party leadership divides basically into grifters and into what we would call lunatics. I mean, on the lunatic side, we've got the obvious. We've got, Michelle Bachmann. We've got Jindal. You've got Huckabee. All the regulars. Mm. But on the grifter side, it's a little less obvious.
Right. It's all about the money.
Exactly. On the grifter side, those people are just as much in charge of what's going on. Now, the grifter side is more from the, if you're talking about the Tea Party angle on it, the grifter side, they're going to be establishment Republicans.
Yeah, when the Christie thing broke, I remember that one of the first times that Rachel really went off on it seriously. After she got off the air, Louise and I were talking, and I said, "I will bet you anything that there's either a billion-dollar development project that's associated with this thing, that there's billions of dollars, this wasn't done out of political spite.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other ways to take down a politician. You, what's the old thing? catch him in bed with a dead hooker or something like whatever it is. I mean, you know, there's lots of ways to take down a politician that don't hurt you yourself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I said there's money to be made here. And also, there was, you know, when he was walking around with his arm around Barack Obama, it was because Obama was hit there to pass out some cash. And he's using that cash. There's something going on here it's all about the money.
It is, Tom. And this story that we're going to be talking about goes beyond just the Chris Christie thing. It goes more to the systemic issue that there's this divide that is, it's a horrible ending for the Republicans, and I don't overstate that at all, because there is no easy way out of this thing. So we're going to have David Haynes talking about that. We're going to have Howard Nations talking about why Democrats have really failed to act on the Citizens United front. What is it that's happening with the Democrats that's really not that much different from what we saw happening with the Republicans? We've had them saying how awful, this is a terrible thing, but right now you simply have 501c4s that are just pumping money into the Democratic Party. Unfortunately, all that money is going to Hillary Clinton right now. It's almost as if Hillary believes that if she has enough money, nobody's going to get involved. Now, we've seen that before, by the way, Tom. We've seen Hillary play this out before, and it's been to her detriment. But that's where the money's going. The Citizens United 501c4 money is going into Hillary's pocket. And it's almost to say to people that are maybe Elizabeth Warren or Schweitzer or whoever may be thinking about running, stay out of it because you can't win. We saw exactly the scenario last time, and it really caused her harm.
Yeah, or make a perfunctory run, and I'll think about you for vice president.
Right, you know, exactly. We'll negotiate.
Yeah, and we'll see how you do, and that'll tell us whether or not we should, you know, think about you as a vice president or something like that. I don't disagree with you. I think the whole thing is fascinating. But the grifter wing of the Republican Party, that's fascinating. And Chris Christie's kind of the poster boy for it.
He is, isn't he?
You know, just follow
McDonald's
the money.
McDonald now, too.
All you got to do is follow the money. We'll be back with Mike Papantonio from Ring of Fire Radio. Check it out, ringoffireradio.com. Stick around. Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you at the top of the hour. Governor Charlie Crist is going to be with us, former Republican governor of Florida, now running as a Democrat. Should be fascinating. Mike Papantonio still on the line with us. Pap, you want to take some phone calls?
Sure.
Okay.
You know, I went to law school with Charlie Crist. We've been friends a long time.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
We've been
friends a very long time.
Even when he was a Republican, I thought he was probably the only rational Republican in the country. I mean,
He proved it. Yeah, it killed him to have to be a Republican, frankly.
Yeah,
he hated it.
And he's a Democrat. Yeah. Anyhow, Mike in Sheridan, I don't know how to say it, in Indiana there. What's the town, Mike?
Sherville.
Thank you. So you had, it says here you have a question for Pap. But it may be from back from when Pap was on. What's up?
He had that blogger on there talking about the Keystone Pipeline, and curious is why Brian Schweitzer now is a big pusher for the Keystone XL Pipeline, and, you know, it gets me as he was on the Ed Schultz today, even taking questions, and I like Ed. I think they're older, but now he's even kind of got Ed pushing for the Keystone Pipeline.
Mike, I'm going to drop this. I don't want to talk about any of my colleagues on the air, frankly. They're not here to defend themselves, and I just don't do that. But the issue of Governor Schweitzer, that's got me scratching my head. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do have thoughts about it. Look, first of all, the thing about this, the discussion that's taking place about Keystone, unfortunately, the report that came out is pretty convincing until you dig below the report. But what we're doing, focusing on Keystone, the threat to me is not, you know, is this going to create more of a problem from an environmental standpoint, which it will. Is it really going to create more jobs that, you know,
35 jobs?
Yeah, which you won't. But isn't the real question, doesn't it take us away from from alternative sources? You know, Bobby Kennedy is my partner in Ring of Fire. Bobby and I are law partners, actually. And I remember when Bobby was attacked on the wind issue. Okay, it was just it was a remarkable attack. It says, you know, Bobby, you're talking about how we have to move to alternative energy and how you know, we need to have wind energy, but you objected to it in your backyard. When that discussion came up, to me, it was that what we're moving away from is the merits of saying no to fossil fuel. That's where this, is the pipeline good or is it bad? It right. actually takes us away from the real discussion. And that, why aren't we talking about geothermal? Why aren't we talking about wind? Why aren't we talking about solar? That's the downside.
Well, and let me take it a step beyond that, Pap. I mean, you got the state of Texas, 20% of their electricity now is being generated by wind. You got the state of Iowa, 24% of their electricity is being generated by wind. These are stories that people don't even know.
Right.
You know, and the inevitability of Keystone and that we need the energy. I'm sorry, this energy, the plan is to transport that oil down to the Gulf Coast so that they can refine it. The Koch brothers and others could refine
yeah,
it down
they're
there.
They're going to make $80 billion.
Right. Expand Cancer Alley, dump more poison into the, you know, going down the road, more of these poisons going into Texas and Louisiana. And it's just, this is crazy.
Happens sometimes, and I don't know what your experience is with this. We have sometimes, and to some degrees, it's a good idea. I mean, we have purists, what I call analytical purists, from an ideological standpoint, that are, whether they're progressive or whether they're, you know, wing nut right wingers.
Right.
Sometimes there is no straight line. Sometimes I've said things on shows and they say, Pap, you know, my God, you know, this is not part of our playbook. How dare you do that? And I get covered up with emails and they're not going to listen to my show anymore. And you know, when I go after Obama, that happens. When I used to go after Harry Reid, that would happen. And I'd say, okay, look, what you really want to do is you want to analyze what's happening here. And what's happening is we're moving away from the important discussion. Which is, it's not, is the Keystone right or wrong? It's well beyond that. Isn't the Keystone issue taking us away from the macro?
What's our energy future?
Exactly. I mean, that's what we ought to be talking about.
And Keystone, in my mind, Keystone slows down.
It does.
You know, and then secondary to that, or maybe even primary to that, maybe even our energy future should be subordinate to it, except for the fact that it's driving it, is, you know, what's our planet's future? I mean, are we hurtling toward extinction? Is it possible? We've never, you know, the human race has never been on this earth when there was more than 400 parts of carbon in the atmosphere.
You do incredible interviews. The Friday program that you do with great minds, when you've talked to so many people about this that's straight up, that say exactly what you're saying. I mean, at some point we say, okay, well, let's start listening.
Mm-hmm.
And Keystone, unfortunately, takes us away from the bigger picture, which is, what about our children? What about our grandchildren? Because we're talking about one pipeline as opposed to, what about all the other alternative? What about yesterday they did away with the tax? They did away with the tax benefit for being for wind. You know, there was some tax benefit for being able to say, I'm going to build a wind farm.
Mm-hmm.
That's the story. You know, that's from a cultural standpoint, that shows what's really happening here. We've missed the big picture. It's like me going in a courtroom and focusing too much on one witness. And I'm saying, oh, my God, what about the trial? You know, and the trial is this bigger picture.
Yeah. It really is. We just have a minute left here to our callers. I'll in Illinois and North Carolina and New York and Wyoming. I'll pick you up on the other side of the break. But Pap, closing thoughts for the week.
Yeah, closing thoughts for the week is there's a lot of things going on, and if you're not paying attention right now, I always tell everybody it's not really about you. It's paying attention to stories that you do, Tom, that Ed Schultz does, that we do on Ring of Fire. It's about stories that you're not going to hear about anywhere else. Now more than ever, those stories are important. You know, I really don't care whether Justin Bieber is racing cars or whether Kim Kardashian wore a blue blouse to some awards banquet or what's happening with Honey Boo Boo. What I care about is we're in this for our children and our grandchildren. And knowledge is power.
Yeah.
Knowledge is power.
Yeah, there you go. And hopefully we're imparting a little power to people. Mike Papantonio, RingofFireRadio.com. Pap, thanks so much for filling in for me today, and thanks so much for hanging around.
Thank you, Tom.
It's great talking with you. And great seeing you. We'll be back. with Governor Charlie Crist.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And in the studio with me, former governor of the great state of Florida, Charlie Crist. And Governor Crist is the author of a new book, The Party's Over, How the Extreme Right Hijacked the GOP and I Became a Democrat. Governor Crist, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's great to be with you
today. Thanks for joining us.
I got to give a shout out to your last guest, Mike Papantonio, dear friend.
Yeah.
Great lawyer.
Yeah.
And a classmate of mine law school.
He mentioned that.
He's a
good guy.
Yes, he is. Very smart.
You were a Republican governor. You became an independent. You're now a Democrat. And you're going to try and take on Rick Scott, arguably one of the most corrupt, at least before he was a governor.
I like to put it, I have a record as having been governor before and attorney general before that and secretary of education before that. Rick Scott has now a record as governor for the past 3.5 years, but he's got a record before that. Mm. And his record before that as the CEO of Columbia HCA Healthcare Company was that company, under his leadership, had to pay the highest fine for fraud in the history of the United States of America at the time, $1.7 billion in a fine.
That's like Jamie Dimon territory.
It's getting there. And, yeah. And you know, as a friend said to me the other day, listen, if you're just in the top 10 of fraudsters or fraudulent companies in America, you know, that's hard to get there.
Well, how does a guy who has been convicted of the one of the largest criminal frauds, right? I mean, you know, it's crimes in the history of the country become the governor of a state? I don't get it.
It's unconscionable. And I think Florida's going to fix it. And that's a big part of the campaign is ethics. When I first got into public service, I was a state senator from the Tampa Bay area, St. Mm-hmm. Pete, represented Tampa, St. Pete, and part of Clearwater. And one of the first committees I got to be chairman of was the Senate Ethics and Elections Committee.
Oh.
And so ethics has always been very important to me because of how, frankly, my mother and father raised my three sisters and me to try to do what's right and to do unto others.
Yeah.
And to try to lead a good life and leave the world a better place.
Right.
And so, you know, the notion that we have a governor now that headed that company, and let's look behind the numbers of the $1.7 billion. It was a health care company. What are they supposed to do, Tom?
Provide health care.
They're supposed to care.
Yeah.
What they cared about was money.
Right.
And what they did under his leadership was what they call upcoding, which is kind of a fancy legal word. For on the street, they call stealing.
Right.
You know, and who are you stealing from when you're a Medicare company and you provide Medicare?
You're
stealing from taxpayers and sick people.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to imagine something so callous.
Well, it's a demonstration. If he spent $75 million bucks becoming governor, it's a demonstration of what money can do, you know, how you can wallpaper over the history. I'm curious why you became a Republican in the first place. My dad was a Republican. I grew up when I was 13, I went door-to-door for Barry Goldwater. I mean, my dad was an Eisenhower Republican who, and frankly, Barry Goldwater in many ways was not I mean, today's moderates are more like gold. The few that are left. I mean,
Richard
Susan
Nixon
Collins.
Would probably be a Democrat today. Oh, I mean, the guy went to China. He started the EPA.
Right.
I mean,
so how do you? What got you into the Republican Party? What caused you to leave it? And why are you running as a Democrat?
I became a Republican the same reason many have in our country, because mom and dad were.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, Tom, it's the same reason I'm a Methodist. Mom and dad are, you know, and religion is like politics in many ways that way. Now, why did I choose to no longer be a Republican? Because the leadership of the party went crazy. And you know, my friend Jeb Bush says it better than I could ever imagine to say it. He says, you know, today's Republican Party leadership is perceived as being anti-women, anti-minority, anti-immigrant, anti-gay couples, anti-environment, anti-education. Right. I mean, pretty soon there's nobody left in the room.
Yeah, except the billionaires and the paranoid white guys.
Right, precisely that. Right, and you know, a guy like Jack Kemp, who I loved and thought was a great man and a great public servant from Buffalo, you know, he used to always say the Republican Party needs to be a big tent. Well, because of the recent development in the Republican Party leadership of today, it's become a pup tent at best.
Mm.
And it's just amazing to see what's happened to it. And so if I'm going to be true to myself and my beliefs and my core principles as instilled in me by Charlie and Nancy Crist, mom and dad, then you couldn't stay there. You know, mm-hmm. if the club goes bad, then you have to do what's right and
so what are
be
the,
brave and go.
What are the issues that you would, you know, you'd say, okay, now I'm a Democrat, and these are the things that I stand for that, well, what are the issues that you're running on?
Okay. Sure. There's several. Ethics, which we've touched on.
Right.
You know, and by
which,
the way,
which
Rick
should
Scott,
be transpartisan.
It absolutely is. It has nothing to do with partisan politics. It has to do, and you know what, to be honest, for me, it's never really been about right versus left. Because of mom and dad, it's much more so always been about right versus wrong.
Right.
And, you know, in an issue like, you know, stealing from taxpayers or patients as the head of a healthcare company and allowing that to happen, you know, and then he had to plead the Fifth Amendment in order to not incriminate himself 75 times under oath.
I wish there was video of that.
Well, there may be. But at any rate, I can tell you this. That's what happened. It's publicly reported.
Yeah.
And I've never pled the Fifth in my life.
Yeah.
In fact, I was, in essence, a law enforcement officer as Attorney General of the state of Florida.
You were the chief law enforcement.
Chief law enforcement officer of the state, yeah. So that's a big difference and a big issue. Education's another one, huge. I'm a public school kid. You know, I believe in honoring our hardworking public school teachers. Two of my three sisters were public school teachers in Florida. This governor, when he gets into office, he recommends a $3.3 billion reduction in the budget, $3.3 billion reduction in the budget in public education. Now, the legislature backed off and said, no, we're only going to cut it $1.3 billion, which is still catastrophic.
Right.
When I was governor, as a Republican, I supported increasing the funding in education. So another huge difference between the two of us. Then you have voter rights, which is huge in Florida, you know, voter suppression, if you will. When I was still a Republican governor in 2008, when it's, you know, McCain versus Obama, what happened is we had long lines for early voting. In the fall of 2008, a friend of mine, he was at the time House Democratic leader Dan Gelber, called me and he said, Governor, you know, you've got to do something to lessen the size of these lines. People are not being able to vote. And so I signed an executive order saying, open them up. You know, we've got to have more polling places and longer hours for voting. And it alleviated the problem, at least as much as we could. Go 4 years later, Rick Scott's governor, also a Republican, and we have long lines, again, longer lines. Mm-hmm. So Dan Gelber and I team up and call him and say, you know, you've got to sign an executive order like I did and let our people vote. Let them free. He wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
So huge contrast. I mean, you know, I'm the opposite of this guy in almost every way.
Right. Wow. Right on down the line.
And then there's the environment. I mean, it goes on and on. It's just unbelievable.
How's the environment in Florida? I used to read John D. McDonald novels, you know, the old Travis McGee series, and he was always going on about the Florida developers and this and that and the other thing.
Yeah.
What is the environmental state of Florida? And as governor, what clear would you do?
Well, one thing I would do is not allow the discharges that I think are starting again today out of Lake Okeechobee.
Mm.
What they do is they allow discharge of a lot of water, hundreds of millions of gallons, into the Caloosahatchee River that goes between Fort Myers and Cape Coral on the west coast of Florida, and into the St. Lucie River going to the east coast of Florida out of Lake Okeechobee. Now, when you allow those discharges, all kinds of pollutants that come down from the agricultural region settle in the lake, and then you let them out in these rivers. And when you do, the rivers look like mud.
Yeah.
And this past year, we had record deaths of manatees in Florida, a lot of them near the Indian River Lagoon, where for a time, children weren't allowed to go swimming because they were getting sick. And it's just horrible. And Governor Scott has the audacity to blame it on the president. Because Dyke is too, I don't know, blames everything on the president. But yeah. At any rate, when I was governor, we stopped the discharges. The river's cleaned up. That's just
great.
One example.
Okay, Charlie Crist, his new book, The Party's Over, how the extreme right hijacked the GOP and I became a Democrat. Governor, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Party's Over. Charlie Crist, is there a website?
Yes, charliecrist.com.
CharlieCrist.com. There you go. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Republican sabotage is killing Americans. Never in the history of our nation has a political party tried so hard to actively sabotage a piece of already passed legislation the way that today's Republican Party is doing with Obamacare. Republicans in Washington and across the nation are so committed to sabotaging President Obama's presidency that they're willing to let people die. While Republicans have failed 47 times to repeal Obamacare, or at the very least defund it at the national level, their relentless sabotage efforts are working very well at the state level. From Texas to Florida, Republicans are preventing millions of Americans from having access to affordable, life-saving health care. Theda Skocpol, a professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, has compiled data showing just how successful Republican sabotage efforts over Obamacare have been. As Skocpol points out, 23 states under Republican control have refused to expand Medicaid under Obamacare and have refused to set up their own state-run health insurance exchanges. As a result, those states have only enrolled a small fraction of their citizens eligible for Medicaid, and their enrollments in the federal health care exchanges aren't much better. Millions of Americans in these states are being denied access to life-saving health care because of Republican sabotage. Similarly, in states choosing to only expand Medicaid or to let the government run their health insurance exchanges but not expand Medicaid, enrollment numbers are just as bad. Again, millions of Americans in those states don't have access to health care because Republicans are putting politics ahead of people's lives. But compare enrollment numbers in Republican-controlled states to those in democratically-controlled states, and the difference is staggering. As Skocpol notes, states like California and New York that have both expanded Medicare under Obamacare and created their own state-run exchanges are having very few problems signing up their citizens for health care. Those states are 43% of the way toward their projected Medicare enrollment numbers and 37% of the way toward their projected enrollment numbers in the exchanges. Skocpol told TPM that you go back to how the law was designed, for better or for worse. It gave states a lot of responsibility. The states have actually done things the way the law envisaged, that have done things the way the law envisaged in this early stage, are doing the most toward those goals. She added that, but the just say no states are putting all their lower income residents at risk, not just by refusing to expand Medicaid, but also, in many cases, by failing to help people get subsidized private coverage through the exchange. And the Republican sabotage in these just-say-no states isn't just keeping Americans from having access to health care. It's keeping money out of their wallets, too. In a recent Daily Take, I discussed how, thanks to their refusal to expand Medicaid under Obamacare, Republican lawmakers in 25 states are preventing people in their states from getting their own tax dollars back in the form of expanded Medicaid. Since the government's picking up 100% of the cost of Medicaid expansion for the next 3 years by refusing to expand the program, Republican lawmakers aren't saving their states any money. Instead, they're preventing their constituents from reaping the rewards of their tax dollars. Even the conservative-leaning fact-checking site PunditPact agreed with the claim, saying, "We rate that statement mostly true." The sabotage we're seeing today from the Republican Party is unprecedented, costly, and deadly. Republican lawmakers are willing to let people die just to put a permanent stain on the Obama presidency, and that is just wrong.
20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Mercury retrograde since yesterday. Uh-oh. Charlie Crist. Charlie Crist is an interesting guy. You know, it's for a former Republican governor. I mean, this is kind of Don Siegelman territory. Don was a Democrat, always was, but he was a governor who was telling the truth, and it so PO'd Karl Rove that Karl Rove got, in my opinion, a very corrupt legal system to put Don Siegelman in prison for literally, if not for doing anything. I mean, you know, it's pretty shocking. You can read all about that over at free-don.com. But charliecrist.com, for Charlie Crist, it's the politics in the South. What kind of state could elect a guy who had been convicted of the biggest fraud in the history of the United States, the biggest criminal fraud, and it had to do with health care, and he becomes governor? Anyway. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, so I'm going to make a couple of points. I would hope at least that there is someone in the Republican Party akin to a William F. Buckley who confronted both privately and, more importantly, publicly, his friend, good friend Barry Goldwater, to say that, you know, this is extremism. This is not what the GOP is or should be.
There is that. There was that person in the Republican Party, and it was David Frum. And he spoke truth to the Republican Party one too many times, and they kicked him out.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, unfortunately, rather than, you know, embracing the kind of discourse that needs to take place, the answer in today's Republican Party is you're simply exiled. You know,
right.
You're out on the island on your own.
Yeah, I mean, we had David Frum on the show a number of times when he was a Republican, and I would debate him, and he would just be honest about stuff. And that was a pretty shocking thing coming from a Republican.
And I think it's important to note that, you know, that for the Republicans, I mean, in part, you know, we can take some solace in that they've created their own little Frankenstein golem, to my Jewish friends, in creating some of these fractured elements of their own party. For instance, the Tea Party, one can argue, is out of the control of the mainstream of the GOP,
right,
and is at odds with them in many cases. So they've created their own little Frankenstein, and it's coming back to bite them. And that, you know, now you can be, you know, Tea Party in a primary, ensuring for many of us, you know, that, you know, that they might just nominate somebody who's so far to the right that they can't win a general election.
Mm-hmm.
And that thereby, you know, moderate or Democrats going to win. And so, you know, it can serve our interests in terms of those who are more progressively minded in terms of their thinking. I also wanted to say that, you know, I mean, we have really got to recapture the narrative. I will watch some of the right-wing net shows only because, you know, it's important to keep track of exactly where some Americans, you know, you don't agree with them, but where they're getting their ideas.
Yeah.
And, you know, and with all due respect to my fellow Americans, we are a nation that is intellectually lazy. We want the sort of McDrive-through answer to complex public policy issues. And so you can tune into Fox and I saw Bill O'Reilly, who wanted to make the point that, well, interviewing President Obama, you know, Obama refers to, you know, the GI Bill, wonderful example of the government using its power, using its finance, to its ability to prop up an entire segment of the society through this legislation, and it went on to repay us in terms of the society exponentially compared to what it cost. So O'Reilly's answer to this is, you know, follow up. Of course, there's no one there, you know, to actually debate him. This is on his show as opposed to an interview
right. With
President Obama. You know, it's, oh, no, that was us paying back the GIs, you know, so you can conveniently distinguish that.
Right. But see, whether it was for paying back the GIs or whether it was because Roosevelt and Truman and Eisenhower and, you know, I think the GI Bill continued to be paying out even under the Kennedy administration, or whether it was because they just were philanthropists. It doesn't matter. If you look at the consequences of the GI Bill, it was incredibly, insanely positive for the United States. And for us to have said, oh, well, you know, that we tried this experiment with the returning soldiers from World War II. It worked out fabulously for our country, so we're just going to abandon it. We're going to stop doing it. That was really, really nuts. And the other countries, you know, after Europe rebuilt, the countries of Europe, they said, hey, look at what they're doing with the GI Bill. Hey, that looks like a pretty good idea. Let's just do that. You know, we don't, you know, our GIs are, you know, dead and gone. Steve, excellent point. Thanks a lot for the call. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Oh, Tom. Yeah, we're going to get this Keystone shoved down our throat anyway, so let's get something.
I'm going to go down kicking, Corky. I'm going to go down kicking. This thing is, let's bring the poison from Canada to the Gulf Coast so that we can sell the diesel fuel and the gasoline to England and China and Mexico and Brazil. And that makes no sense to me. I understand, you know, that there will be some construction jobs, and I understand, you know, and I know that there's at least one union that has picked up this banner and said, okay, you know, we'll take those jobs for a couple of years and build that pipeline. And, you know, I know, you know, I get it. Jobs are important to people, but those jobs are going to go away once that construction is done, and you're going to just have, you know, security jobs. And, but secondly, this is incredibly toxic stuff. If it is so important that we have, quote, North American energy independence, which means we continue buying imported oil, we just buy it from Canada instead of Saudi Arabia. If that's so important, let them refine it in Canada, and we'll buy it as gasoline and diesel fuel. It's a whole lot. You're shipping a lot less stuff. Canada gets to keep the poison, but the fact of the matter is that Canada is unwilling to poison itself. The province of Alberta is unwilling to poison itself, and they're going to profit from this, and the government of Canada as a whole. You can't build a refinery up there that will refine this stuff in a way that will keep the poisons intact, and which is why they want us to do it. We're playing the role of third world, you know, beaten dog or something. There are other words you could use, I suppose. But it's like we should not be playing that role. Our role in the world should not be, yeah, we'll take your poison. We'll help a transnational corporation, TransCanada. We'll help you make billions of dollars. We'll help the Koch brothers make billions of dollars. We'll get screwed. Sure, no problem. That shouldn't be our role.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And then on top of that, we're opening up the second largest pool of carbon in the world to the atmosphere. Really? It's the good, the bad, and the very, very specifically ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com. The good, the Ogallala Sioux Nation. The American Indian Tribe has announced that it will join in with other Native American activist groups in opposing the Keystone XL pipeline because of the risk it poses to the environment. As the nation said in a joint press release put together with other groups like Protect the Sacred and Honor the Earth, quote, this pipeline will, in fact, increase carbon emissions and cause grave and irreversible environmental harm globally. This pipeline would cause direct environmental harm and put the well-being of all who live in relationship with the Ogallala Aquifer at risk. End of quote. The Ogallala Sioux are spot on when it comes to the Keystone XL pipeline. Let's just hope President Obama is listening. The bad. Sam Zell. During a Wednesday interview on Bloomberg TV, the super-rich founder and chairman of the investment firm Equity International defended the idea that the 1% are being persecuted like Jews in Nazi Germany. As he put it, the 1% should be emulated, not envied.
The problem is that the world and this country should not talk about envy of the 1%. It should talk about emulating the 1%. The 1% work harder. The 1% are much bigger factors in all forms of our society.
Right. I'm sure the 1% works so hard sitting by the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive. And the very, very ugly, that crazy anti-Obama lady. during a recent town hall hosted by Republican Congressman Jim Bridenstine. An unidentified woman went on a tirade against President Obama, calling for his execution as an enemy combatant. Check this out.
Obama, he's not president, as far as I'm concerned. He should be executed as an enemy combatant.
You don't know that.
But the Muslims that he is shipping into our country through pilots in commercial jets, I can't tell you, I can't say in a public place, this guy is a criminal.
You know what the worst part of all this is? Congressman Bridenstine didn't even try to shoot down that thought bubble from that woman. He just kept on talking about how tyrannical Obama is. And that is very, very ugly. Actually, it's the congressman who should be the ugly, not the woman. The woman is just, you know, either mentally ill or she's spent too much time watching Fox News, or both. The congressman, though, he's supposed to be like, you know, a congressman, representative of the people. That's bizarre. Ken in Great Falls, Montana. Hey, Ken, you wanted to talk about the Keystone Pipeline and you like it?
No, I don't like it. I want to thank everybody that's against it, but I have an idea how we could stop it by having the president okay it, because he would okay it with one condition. It's the condition that the right all want, is that all of the oil that would travel through the pipeline, matter of fact, all the oil that travels through any pipeline in America or comes out of America must be consumed in America.
Ha! I would put an end to it right there.
Exactly. So he does it with that condition, plus put a tax on any oil product that is exported, not lubricants, just fuels,
right,
from this country. And you say that this is a national security thing. We're importing 40% now. And you say that when we get down to 10% importation of oil, at that point those laws will go off. Well, that'll take 20 years.
Yeah.
So in 20 years, if we can't massively stop the use of oil, it's all over anyway.
Yeah, the speed with which, by the way,
its tracks.
Yeah, the speed with which we're picking up wind and solar right now, it's going to take a lot less than that to drop those imports. Plus, the speed with which we've been increasing domestic drilling and fracking. And I'm not advocating that. I'm simply stating the facts that our oil imports are going down, and they're going to start going down a whole lot faster. On the other hand, as the economy picks back up, assuming we they are successful in pushing us into another bubble, which is really debatable, we may even see an increase in our fossil fuel consumption, which is a bad thing. Ken, thanks for the call. Interesting thought. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. I'm still opposed to passing. Hey, Steve,
yeah,
what's up?
Yeah, there was good news today. Lawrence Livermore is making a laser beam that will be able to generate 100,000 times all the generating capacity of the planet combined. It has that much power and ability to generate and utilize power. And what that will do is your high-level nuclear waste can be reduced to salt, and then you can sprinkle it on a nice rare steak.
So you've got a laser beam that will cause uranium to break down to sodium and chloride? Is that what you're saying? And how much energy is that going to take?
It takes a lot of energy, but the point is it generates a lot of energy.
Laser is an acronym for light amplification through the stimulated emission of radiation. And the stimulated part is the important. It takes energy to produce a laser. And so if you're using the laser, I mean, I how does a laser produce energy when, you know, a laser is just a fancy way of, it's coherent light. It's light where it's all polarized, you know, with the exact same polarity, you know, within, you know, a fraction of a degree. It's not even like vertically or horizontally polarized. It's totally coherent light, which is what makes it a laser, you know, light as distinguished from all other forms of light that are, you know, diffuse, that have all polarities. And how does that produce electricity or produce energy greater than the energy put into it without being a perpetual motion machine?
Well, the point is that it will end the straw dog of nuclear waste, which is
basically Well, you know, it's good news if you can end the straw dog of nuclear waste, but it's not good news if it takes 100,000 gigawatts to do it.
Well, yeah, but if you have nuclear power, then you don't have to worry about it. You're just making more power. It is.
And produce more waste that you've got to use the power to nuke the waste. No, Steve, you haven't sold me. I'm sorry. I'll have to read the thing. Gene in Kettle Falls, Washington. Hey, Gene.
That's Glenn. How you doing?
Oh,
Tom?
Glenn, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
You know, I got new glasses too. It's just I just glanced over too quickly.
How's your day?
It's going really, really well, I hope. I think.
I had an
interesting meeting this morning.
Degrees.
Yeah. Yeah, it's colder than there was an old Fire Sign Theater routine about that, but I forget the words. But it's mighty cold in Washington State right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's cold all over the country. I can't believe this hottest and coldest year we've had in a long time, and they're still talking about building a pipeline. You know what I don't hear enough of about the pipeline? I called for something else, but I want to put this up. The
Ogallala Aquifer.
Aquifer. It's 2 million year old. What do you call it?
Rock and water formation. Aquifer.
Yeah. I mean, it's the cleanest water on the planet.
Yes.
And pipelines leak. As a matter of fact, I think 6 months or 8 months ago, an XL pipeline broke in Arkansas and flooded a whole neighborhood.
Yeah.
With black goo and tar. And
yeah, and they're still trying to clean up the Kalamazoo River from almost 2 years ago.
We're having major water problems, you know.
Yeah.
I mean.
And the problem with this tar sands oil is that normal oil floats on top of water. This oil sinks below water, so it'll sink right through the ground, right down into the aquifer. It ain't a good thing.
I can't even believe the Canadian people let them do that.
Well, they're not. They're saying, hey, look at this. We got this carbon here. It can be burned. It's incredibly dirty. It's incredibly poisonous. It's incredibly corrosive. Let's give it to the Americans.
Yeah, no kidding. We'll take anything. Well, they're turning this country into a toxic waste dump.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly what it is. The Keystone XL pipeline is an attempt to turn America into a toxic waste dump. You said, Gene, you wanted to talk about something else. Let's get to it real quick. I got a whole bunch of calls here.
You had mentioned some scoundrel that was just elected governor of a state.
Charlie Crist. Not Charlie Crist, excuse me. The man Charlie Crist is challenging. Rick Scott, yes, thank you. My Republican governors badly.
W. Bush Jr. is a convicted felon, and nobody even brought that up.
Which felony was George W. Bush convicted of?
Well, drunk driving.
Oh, yeah, drunk driving. You don't think of that as a felony, but yeah. Yeah, I remember that. That conviction came out just before the election and bounced his ratings around enough that he was within spitting distance of having to use the Supreme Court to get himself elected. And the Republicans were all yelling dirty tricks.
Within weeks after that, he showed him at his ranch with a rifle in his hands.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, he claims that he's sober, and he may well be, although I will never buy this story that he choked on a potato chip and fell over and hit his face exactly the way people do when they pass out from being drunk. While he was watching the Super Bowl or something like that,
This guy's a convicted felon, and the Democrats never even pulled that out of.
You know, Glenn, whether George W. Bush was convicted of drunk driving or not really doesn't concern me. The fact that George W. Bush lied us into a war that devastated international relations, that tore apart the Middle East, that has killed well over 100, maybe well over 200,000 or 300,000 people, including thousands of Americans. That basically opened the gates of hell. You know, 5 million Iraqi, 5+ million Iraqi internal and external refugees, and then the contagion for the countries around it. That, you know, and torturing people. I mean, the war crime stuff.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, George W. Bush should be held accountable for his war crimes long before we sit around and complain about the fact that he was an alcoholic when he was young. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. How you doing, my friend?
Yes, sir, Professor Hartman, Brother Hartman.
Nice to hear your voice, Sam. How are you?
Hey, Yeah, I got to go back to the doctor tomorrow. But I wanted to report about the water situation here in our state,
mm-hmm.
about the chemicals leaking in the Elk River.
Yep.
Well, for the third time, they're having to close down them three schools, and the cooks got sick yesterday because the licorice smell was so strong that Saturday they're staging a protest. The people are standing up.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have a march on the Freedom Works, and they're going to occupy that place. And they're really, man, they're so upset. They're going to really come down on them. And it's 10 o'clock Saturday, people.
10 o'clock Saturday. Are you talking about Freedom Industries, the chemical company, or Freedom Works, the political lobby, the chemical company? Okay. And in what town?
Charleston, West Virginia.
In Charleston, West Virginia.
Saturday,
10 o'clock.
March, the citizens and the customers of the water company, too.
Right.
And they're staging a big protest march, and they're going, I guess they're going to occupy it.
That's great.
And
that's great. Well, Sam, you know, let us know how it works out, okay? Give us a shout next week.
Yes, sir.
Fill us in. Thank you, sir. Thank you so much for watching Free Speech TV. I do truly appreciate it, and it's nice to hear your voice. I wish you the very best with the doctor tomorrow, my friend. Paul in Salida, Colorado. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I just had come across some interesting facts that on some of our petroleum interests, and one is that we have record high costs for propane all over the Midwest, and that's affecting many, many, many people. We actually found a woman in South Dakota who was dead in her house who had an empty propane tank, and they suspect that she froze to death. She was a Native American. At the same time, we are flaring off 25% of all the natural gas produced in the Bakken up in North Dakota, where
right.
my brother-in-law farms, and I know it intimately up there, and it's a horror show.
We're flaring it because they're just sucking it out of the ground so fast that they don't have time to do it right, or they're not taking the time to do it right.
They are so excited about getting the $100 oil out of the ground that they could care less about the natural gas that's produced,
wow.
and they're just flaring it off.
Wow.
And at the same time, we're having record high exports of propane out of the United States.
Oh, really?
Well, our people are, yes, record high exports.
Well, I know last year the number one export from the United States was refined petroleum products, which is amazing.
Right.
I mean, you know, we're importing all this oil, and we got to have the Keystone XL pipeline, but our number one export was not cars, it was not clothes, it wasn't even, you know, rock and roll. Our number one export, it wasn't software, you know, it wasn't Microsoft. Our number one export in terms of dollars was refined petroleum products. Tell me there's not something really, really weird about that.
Yeah, now that we're exporting raw natural gas products, compressed natural gas and
yeah.
propane
out LNG.
In the United States, we are throwing away our resources at a time when...
Well, we've become a third world country. You know, we used to export manufactured goods. We used to import raw materials. We would import, you know, the coke, in the stuff you make steel out of. We would import iron ore and export manufactured cars and washing machines and TV sets and all kinds of cool stuff and blue jeans. We were the world, you know, the world bought our Levi's. Now they don't even make Levi's in the United States anymore. Paul, thanks for the call. We'll be back with Ellen Ratner. And welcome back. Ellen Ratner with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan, goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
And yeah. I'll be in South Sudan a month from today, so.
So you are going.
I am, of course.
They're,
Tom.
They're killing people over there.
Not in my area. They're not. Not in the area you were in.
Okay, go on.
Now. They were when you were there. They were,
but, yeah, yeah. Actually, yeah. When
right.
we flew out, we were watching
yeah.
them burn a village over,
right,
right over the border
yeah.
in Darfur. I
yeah,
mean, that's,
right, exactly. Well, that's not happening now.
Okay, well, that's good.
Not in our area.
Yeah. Well, you travel safely.
Well, thank you.
Via Condeos.
Yes.
So
Samantha Power has yeah. tweeted, as she is our United States ambassador to the United Nations.
Right.
She has tweeted, she said, "I can't sing, but if Pussy Riot will have me, I say our first concert is for Russia's political prisoners."
Wow. Well, Well, how about Don Siegelman? How about America's political prisoners?
Exactly. Now, thank you very much. We haven't talked about Governor Siegelman in a while.
Yeah,
but...
in way too long.
Yes.
And it's, you know, Russia does not have a monopoly on political prisoners. And Russia has fewer prisoners overall per capita and in absolute numbers.
And so does China.
Than the United States. So I don't get it why, and this has nothing to do with being on RT or anything else. I just don't get it. Maybe I actually see it more clearly, I think, because I don't get it why all this coverage is about exploding toothpaste tubes when there's absolutely no evidence of that, rather than the typical coverage that you get about Olympics, which is who are our teammates, where are they from, what
well,
are they competing
that, that's
in?
That's absolutely one, and I will tell you something else about it. They're all flipped out about the water. Well, you travel as I do. Do you go into a foreign country and brush your teeth out of the sink? I certainly have never done that.
No, I always use beer.
I'm serious,
because you know it's got alcohol and it's disinfected.
I bottle water. Whatever I do, I'm very, very careful. And, you know, Leningrad, or former Leningrad, now back to St. Petersburg, they have a special little microorganism that people there don't get sick from. But if we go, we get sick. So, I mean... wherever you go in the world,
same in Cancun.
What else is new?
I
can't believe that they're making such a big to-do about
this. It's like 2 days ago, somebody flipped a switch someplace, and it was like, let's bash Russia. And, you know, I get it. They've got a problem with gay people. Well, we did just 20 years ago. I mean, Russia's only been an independent republic, you know.
You know, when I first did my first gay march, which was Labor Day 1970, if you had told me that there was going to be, in this country, gay marriage, I would have told you you were on Mars.
Right. And I'm saying in 20 years, you'll see Russia being where we are right now. Because they're right where we were 20 years ago. And how do we get on this high and mighty, don't get me started.
Well, I want to get started with something else for you. This does not come from talk radio news. This comes from the Hill, but sometimes something is so interesting that I just have to give somebody else's news for them. And as you know, I always tell our staff, don't ever say or do anything you don't want on the front page of the Washington Post. And I mean it. Well, apparently somebody was able to record a conversation between Victoria Nuland, who was the spokesperson and now assistant secretary for the State Department, and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And the lack of European or the way European Union is handling the whole Ukrainian situation. And right. She used the F word in a private conversation, apparently.
Right.
And it went on YouTube.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Is she going to keep her job?
I have no idea. But, but it was a private conversation.
I was talking about this on Monday on this program. We spent a fair amount of time on it. I got a bunch of like history professors calling in and talking about the parallels between 1914 and today and how Western Ukraine speaks Ukrainian. Yushchenko, the current president, didn't even learn Ukrainian until he was 50. Eastern Ukraine is ethnically Russian and they all speak Russian. You've got a cocktail there that's the perfect formula for a civil war. And then John Kerry goes over and says, we're with you. And he's really only speaking to the western half
of
the country.
Right, who's he speaking to?
Right.
Well, you know,
and
we have two staff people there right now.
Talk Radio News does?
Yes. I don't know if you've been talking to them or not. We can ask them to call
in. In Ukraine.
They're in Ukraine right now.
I would love to talk to somebody who's in Ukraine.
There are two guys that always go everywhere
We've got a defense treaty with, Ukraine has a defense treaty with NATO, and they also have a treaty with Russia. And if they were to split into a civil war, this could be a World War I kind of situation where it starts, the dominoes falling, and I'm concerned about this.
I'm very concerned about it. That's why we decided, you know, we can send people to hot spots anywhere, and we decided to send them to Ukraine this week for that very reason, because I have the exact same concern that you do.
Yeah, yeah.
And don't forget, I mean, Ukraine was a place that the Nazis came in and just decimated people on the Babi Yar, which was Yom Kippur.
Yeah.
I mean, thousands of people they just killed in one area. And so it has the potential to go. And Russia, as you know, they sent people out and fought the Nazis and were able to be successful.
And Russia has been invaded three times in the 20th century through that territory or within the boundary of that territory. It used to be called the Ukraine because Ukraine is an old word that used to mean border. You know, it was the border territory.
Right.
It was the buffer between Western Europe and Russia. And it's just, I mean, there's a lot going on there that Americans just are not paying attention to, and we should.
And we should. That's why we have two people there, but I'll get them on
instead,
your show.
Instead of talking about, you know, is there an exploding toothpaste tube on her? And, you know, it's like, come on.
Don't, I mean, I can't even. You haven't heard us reporting that stuff. No, we just don't care about that stuff. Okay. Very interesting Senator Lindsey Graham, as I always call him, Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire, and Senator McCain today wrote a letter to the president saying, given your interview with Bill O'Reilly, we have the following questions. And one is, why do you keep referring to the video and protest as a cause for the attack when your administration knew from eyewitnesses that it didn't happen? And secondly, you said in the Rose Garden that justice will be done, and how come nobody's been apprehended? And this is the continuing pounding away at the Obama administration about Benghazi. They do not let go.
Right. And the president pushed back, didn't he?
No, they haven't pushed back. This is just the letter today, unless I...
Oh, to,
this
a letter from...
went today.
From whom?
From Lindsey Graham, Kelly Ayotte.
From the senators. I'm sorry, I missed that part.
I was maybe I wasn't clear.
No, I was thinking about something else. I thought it was Bill O'Reilly. That's incredible. That's incredible.
Yes.
Amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Check out goatsfortheoldgoats.com.
Thank you.
Goats for the old goat.
I'm the old goat.
There you go.
Goats.
The goats, yeah, there you go. .com helping out the slaves in South Sudan. Ellen's little charity. We'll be back. It is just a minute or so before the top of the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Okay, let me be very, very clear about this. Clayton Williams, back in 1990, he was the Republican candidate for governor of Texas against Ann Richards, as I recall. Ann ended up winning, by the way. And he said during that campaign about rape, and I quote, "As long as it's inevitable, you may as well lie back and enjoy it," end quote. Obviously, that was an incredibly insane and ignorant comment, and arguably it lost him the election. Fast forward 24 years. Today, that's the argument that's being used, the same insane rationale with regard to the Keystone XL pipeline. They're saying, hey, as long as it's inevitable, we should just accept it and learn to love it. They're also saying that America is a fossil fuel dependent nation and that the Keystone Pipeline will help lower gas prices in America and make us more energy independent. But A, the Keystone Pipeline is not inevitable. B, America does not have to be a fossil fuel dependent nation. And C, the oil from the Keystone Pipeline is not going to do anything to help gas prices in this country or make us less fossil fuel dependent. The Keystone Pipeline is not about America and fossil fuels. It's about TransCanada, a Canadian transnational corporation, wanting to get their incredibly dirty fossil fuel out of Canada and into some third world country that's willing to refine it and keep the poison so that they can export it to China. Big oil supporters and pundits across the media have been saying that the use of tar sands oil from Canada and the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline are inevitable. It's not true. On Monday's episode of The Big Picture, I talked with Susan Casey Lefkowitz, director of the International Program for the National Resources Defense Council, about the State Department's report on what the Keystone XL pipelines that was, what the report said, the report that was released last week. I asked her if the report said that extracting tar sands oil from Canada was an inevitable process. And she was quite clear about it. She said tar sands oil development is not inevitable, no matter what the pundits and the big oil supporters are going to try and tell you. She pointed out that some people have even said that if we don't build the Keystone XL pipeline, dirty and toxic tar sands oil will still be transported across the United States by rail. But due to its complex nature, I mean, that's the argument that's made, but due to its complex nature, tar sands oil isn't well equipped to travel by train. And it's also more expensive to transport by rail, so it's really not a viable option. Either way you slice it, the use of tar sands oil is not inevitable. We don't have to, or the Canadians don't have to, extract that dirty, toxic, dangerous stuff from the ground. Now, what about the talking point that America is a fossil fuel-dependent nation, and that we're going to be for the foreseeable future, and that because of that, building the Keystone Pipeline makes sense? Well, America is becoming less and less of a fossil fuel-dependent nation. The U.S. solar industry had its second-largest quarter ever during the third quarter of 2013. Residential solar power installations were up 45% in 2013 from 2012. In Texas alone, covering half a roof with a solar panel is enough to generate all of the electricity used by an average family in the Lone Star State. Thanks to the boom in solar power used in America last year, the U.S. outpaced Germany in solar panel installations for the first time in 15 years. But solar power isn't the only clean and green form of energy on the rise. Wind power is also gaining traction. Wind power accounted for 42% of new energy generating capacity back in 2012, making wind power the number one source of new energy capacity that year in the United States. In Iowa alone, wind power generated nearly a quarter of that state's electricity in 2012. In Texas, it accounted for nearly 10% of energy generated. Finally, what about the arguments that oil from the Keystone XL pipeline will help reduce gas prices across the nation and make us more energy independent? Well, even TransCanada has said that oil from the Keystone XL pipeline isn't guaranteed to stay in America. Back in 2012, during a congressional hearing on the pipeline project, Alex Pourbaix, the head of TransCanada's pipeline division, was asked if he would support legislation requiring Canadian tar sands oil and its byproducts to be sold only in the United States. And he replied, "No, I can't do that." And a whole bunch of other studies have found that much of the oil transported through the Keystone XL pipeline is going to be exported. That's why they're trying to get it to the Gulf of Mexico. We won't see a drop of that toxic, dirty, and dangerous tar sands oil unless, of course, we're forced to deal with a tar sands oil spill disaster. The Keystone XL pipeline will cause gas prices to rise, not fall. A report by Consumer Watchdog found that if the Keystone XL pipeline is approved, Americans, especially in the Midwest, will see higher gas prices adding up to an additional $3 to $4 billion a year. That's roughly a 20 to 40% increase on a gallon of gas in the Midwest and a few cents increase everywhere else. Because right now, the Keystone pipeline ends in the Midwest. And, you know, in refineries in St. Louis and Ohio and Indiana and Missouri, Ohio, Indiana. You shut those refineries down, you move all that stuff down to the Gulf Coast, and you start exporting it, guess what happens? The price of gas goes up in the Midwest. We fought hard to make our voices heard about the Keystone XL pipeline over the past few years. And finally, the government is beginning to realize the grave effects that the Keystone XL pipeline could have on our climate. But the fight isn't over. We cannot let those people who think that that pipeline is inevitable peddle that story, or that America is always going to be a fossil fuel-dependent nation. We can't let them erase the progress that we've made. Most importantly, we need to make it clear to Big Oil, the Obama administration, and their supporters that we aren't going to just sit back. We aren't just going to lie back and enjoy the Keystone XL pipeline and the toxic, dirty, and dangerous oil that it could be transporting. It's time to stop the environmental rape of America and our planet once and for all. Enough. Enough. Philip in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE, it says you haven't made up your mind about the Keystone Pipeline. Really?
Well, my inclination is to be against it. I mean, it really is.
Tell me one reason that anyone would be for it. Just one.
I can't think of one.
The only reason I can think of is I own stock in Koch Industries, and I want to make a lot of money on the stock dividends.
I live on Social Security, so I don't have stock in Koch Industries.
Right, and neither do I. And so, you know, odds are that neither one of us are going to make any money off it, so why? I can't think of any other reason that anybody would support this thing. I said this in the last hour, I get it that there is one, maybe two unions that are supportive of this because, you know, you're looking at 2-3 years worth of construction jobs. And, you know, I understand people are desperate for jobs, but I think that that's a strong argument for doing things that put people back to work, like building our infrastructure, not building a pipeline across America for a foreign company.
Absolutely. My question is, and this comes down, I guess, sort of to the inevitability that you were talking about just a few seconds ago.
That stuff has been in the ground. They've known that stuff was in the ground for 60 years. It's not inevitable that it get out. It's only going to get out if they can figure out a way to get it out of there.
Okay. The question I have is, now this comes from people that support the pipeline. I will say that. But they're pushing this idea that the states just have to approve the pipelines. The only thing the federal government is approving is this 1 mile between the U.S. and Canada. And if they don't approve that, they're just going to build a facility on this side of the border and pipeline it down to the Gulf anyway.
It's possible. I don't know. If the argument has come down to that, then we're in pretty damn sad shape. I have not heard that argument, Philip. But, you know, the Koch brothers are fixing to make $100 billion off this thing, according to published reports I've seen, which seems like a lot to me.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The bottom line is somebody's going to make $100 billion, and if you can make $100 billion, you can certainly spend a few million to buy public opinion. That's not a good thing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Ed, watching Free Speech TV in Pleasant Plains, Illinois. Ed, you're on the air. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Pretty good. I was just thinking, you spoke of a couple of things in the Constitution. One of them is equal protection before the law.
Yeah.
Okay, the other one thing is that it's going on is that with the recent court decision that money is speech.
Right.
Well, they have more speech than we do. That means we have unequal protection.
That's right. That's right. It's circular logic, isn't it?
Anything like that with that?
It's circular logic. Well, see, the money is speech argument is a First Amendment argument, and you're trying to rebut it with a 14th Amendment argument. And,
yeah.
and you know, I'm with you, but on the 14th Amendment, they're saying that, you know, equal protection means that corporations get equal standing with humans. The First Amendment argument is that money is protected by the free speech provision of the Constitution, of the First Amendment, excuse me.
So we're screwed anyway.
Until we pass an amendment to the Constitution that says money is property, not speech, and it's not protected by the First Amendment, and corporations are voluntary associations and legal fictions, not people, so they're not protected by the 14th Amendment. Until we say that clearly, unambiguously, and explicitly, like moveToAmend.org does in their sample amendment, we're in trouble. We're not screwed totally. I mean, there's still a lot of fight left in us, and there's still a lot of people standing up, and there are still some places, you know, particularly smaller states, where it is possible for an honest politician to get elected, witness Vermont, because you can do retail politics, and you can beat the power of money in those places, and in a lot of congressional districts, frankly, which is why you've got 90-some-odd members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. But
they still have more protection than we do.
That's right. But it is David versus Goliath, and we be David.
So we can't use the 14th Amendment?
Well, I mean, you know, you could try to, but if you take it before this Supreme Court, They are not going to buy that argument. That argument was made in Citizens United pleadings, or arguments to that effect were made in the Citizens United pleadings, and they were rejected.
I see. Well,
which takes us back to judicial supremacy, you know, this bizarre doctrine that somehow the Supreme Court, the Article III branch of government, the third among equals, the what Alexander Hamilton said, the least harmful of all, because they have neither the power of the purse nor the power of the militia. You know, in other words, Congress controls the purse, the executive branch runs the army. The Supreme Court has neither. They have no police force. They have no way to enforce their decisions unless the other two branches decide to go along with them. You know, the Supreme Court famously told Andrew Jackson that he could not export the Cherokee Indians out of Georgia and on the Trail of Tears to Oklahoma, and he said, tough luck, I'm going to do it anyway, and he did. In fact, he said, Justice Marshall has made his decision, let's see him enforce it. And Justice Marshall, of course, had no way to enforce the decision, and so the Trail of Tears happened over the explicit objections of the Supreme Court. But that least offensive branch of government has now become the branch of government that basically creates and arbitrates not just, you know, what law means in the United States, but what law is. And that's the job of the First Amendment branch of government, according to the Constitution. So it's just, you know, we've gone off the rails here. You got to get over to movetoamend.org, sign up, and participate. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Harmon here with you. Welcome back. Steve in Chicago. Let's stand WCPT at River Forest. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I really enjoyed that discussion with you and Charlie Crist, and it made me think about how almost every time I hear one of these modern Republicans open their mouth, I hear the ghost of Ayn Rand. And this belief, this implied belief that there's only two kinds of people on this planet, those who value individual liberty and those who are the enemies of individual liberty. It's a false dichotomy.
Yeah. Well, most dichotomies are false dichotomies. I agree with you. Yeah, and I think Charlie Crist gets it. I mean, he's clearly a perceiver, not a judger. He's one of those people who can see shades of gray, and the party's over. What a great title for a book. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, you wanted to talk about the Keystone Pipeline?
Yes, I do, Tom. But first, talking about the Koch brothers, I saw a movie a while back with Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd, Jamie Lee Curtis. It was called Trading Places, and Ralph Bellamy and Don Ameche played two investor brothers who were so nasty, and they reminded me of the Koch brothers. So,
oh, that's interesting.
Trading.
I've never seen the movie, so I can't.
Oh, it's so funny. Go check it out. It is a riot, and you'll see it's totally Koch brothers.
This is the one where Eddie Murphy is he's a poor guy and the rich guy asks him to swap spots or something for some reason because somebody's trying to kill him or something.
Yes, with Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah,
it's so funny. It's so funny. You'd love it, Tom.
I'll have to check it out.
Okay, so now about the Keystone XL pipeline.
Right.
Well, you know, you remember we saw the devastating Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the pictures were horrific, and the wind speeds were 200 miles an hour. A 737 takes off at 165 miles per hour, and in the not-too-distant past, we had 80 tornadoes trashing the Midwest, and the winds were between 170 and 190 miles an hour. Well, there's a place called Cushing, Oklahoma, and it's the linchpin as far as I'm concerned. Cushing is where all the oil, the bitumen, comes down to Cushing, and Cushing is like an endless horizon of giant steel storage tanks holding from 50 to 65 million barrels of crude. It's like a spider web of pipes and pumps and compressors and terminals. Well, it just turns out, by the way, Cushing calls itself the pipeline capital of the world. Well, it turns out that the largest tornado, Cushing is in Tornado Alley right next to Texas there, and the largest tornado ever recorded was the El Reno tornado, ELRENO, if you want to Google that, El Reno tornado. It was 2.8 miles wide. It was called an EF5 tornado. It was the strongest one, and the winds were going at 296 miles per hour, almost 300 miles per hour. Now, a tornado a week earlier in the area, by the way, the El Reno tornado was headed headed toward Cushing, but veered off at the last minute.
Wow.
And a tornado a week earlier took a 10-ton water tank and threw it a half a mile over a school. So this is the potential. And global warming is just speeding up because of the heating up of the atmosphere. Tornadoes, hurricanes are just getting bigger and bigger. So this place, this Cushing, is absolutely in harm's way. And I don't see how anybody could insure a place like this with the record, the largest tornado in the world moving through the area. Plus, there's a fault line underneath the area, and it's called the Wilzetta Fault. And in 2009, there were 50 earthquakes in there, and then they started fracking the area, and there was 1,000 earthquakes. So from above, you get the biggest tornado in the world, and from below, you have a fault line. And this is Cushing, Oklahoma. Google it. Read all about it. You won't believe it. It's disastrous.
Is it also over the Ogallala Aquifer?
I think it's further down than that.
Uh-huh.
Further down. Yeah,
okay.
It's right on the Texas-Oklahoma border, Tornado Alley.
Yeah.
What a place.
Amazing.
It's the worst.
Amazing.
The worst.
Amazing. Harvey, you are a font of knowledge. Thank you. Thank you for calling and sharing that with
me
and with all of our listeners and viewers. Paul in Patchogue. How do you say that, New York, Paul?
That's Patchogue, New York.
Patchogue, New York. Thank you for listening to WBAI. What's on your mind, Paul?
Yeah, I tell you, great show. I'm a relatively new listener, but you should be one of the mainstreams on, like, the mainstream TV. Instead of listening to the same stuff we hear all the time.
Well, thank you.
Anyway, but I was listening to your response on the sugar.
Uh-huh.
You wanted to tax sugar.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking that would be more of a regressive tax where those who can least afford it end up paying higher prices. However, what I would think is we want more of a progressive tax, so let's tax the wealthy and subsidize the produce industry. So instead of paying $1.89 for a tomato, we can get tomato for maybe 39 cents a pound.
Yeah, I would do it as a two-step thing, Paul. I mean, we just passed a $1 trillion farm bill, and much, if not most, of that farm bill is going to subsidize big ag. And I would instead have, if we're going to subsidize agriculture, and in principle, I don't object to subsidizing agriculture. I object to subsidizing, like, the corn industry so that they can make high fructose corn syrup and ethanol, and that's crazy. I could see subsidizing a nascent hemp industry, you know, because hemp is the most efficient converter of sunlight into cellulose that is known on planet Earth. Hemp and kudzu are right up there. Although hemp makes, you know, diesel fuel and oils and plastics and all kinds of cool things. But I would say tax sugar and subsidize fruits and vegetables, fresh fruits and vegetables. We're importing those things into the United States now. And in many cases, we're importing them contaminated with diseases, things like E. coli and salmonella and whatnot. So tax the sugar, subsidize those things so that in poor neighborhoods, the cheapest food is the stuff that's good for you. And, you know, then you go a long way towards solving the nation's obesity problem, especially, you know, as it hits kids, because we now we're finding that basically obesity is set up before people are 10 years old, lifelong obesity. And that's a scary thing. Go ahead.
Sure. And one more suggestion I'd like to make is I was at Zuccardi Park during the Occupy movement for about 12 times. But now that we have a new mayor who appears to be more, you know, friendlier, I wouldn't say we set a gate to reoccupy Zuccardi Park, and then maybe we can get the movement running full steam ahead.
That sounds like a fine idea, Paul. I don't know the politics of the Occupy movement in New York City right now well enough to know how and when and, you know, what process would be done to do that. But it's certainly, you brought the subject up in the New York market. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
To take it to a larger question, is it time to occupy America? I think so. Talk Media for the rest of us, the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Program, welcome back. And Shirley in Emmonsburg, Iowa. Hey, Shirley, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Tom. Yeah, two or three things if you got time. And main thing I called in about was I wonder how many people would vote for that pipeline and be for it if they knew that the Chinese own a very large share of TransCanada, who is the ones that are behind the pipeline.
So what's your source for that information, Shirley?
I watch Chinese television quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
And I saw on that program one of the Canadian leaders visiting with the Chinese leaders about it. And then I checked it out on my computer and found out, yes, the Chinese did go ahead and put in several billion dollars into TransCanada.
Well, several billion is not necessary.
The only reason I can see that they would do that is if they expect to get the finished product out of the other end.
Yeah.
I don't have anything against the Chinese. I respect them for what they've done.
It would be interesting, something that I should have done a long time ago and I haven't done is pull up the stock, go to one of the investment sites and pull up the, a 10-year chart or a 5-year chart of TransCanada's stock price, assuming that it's publicly traded. I mean, it might be privately held, but if it's publicly traded or any of the companies that are associated with this, the Koch brothers, I guess, own, a fair amount of the stuff up in Canada, and they also own a fair amount of the refineries down in Texas, but they're not publicly traded.
If you go to your computer, you can check out with the oil company paper down in Texas,
right,
and find out a lot of what I've just told you.
Okay, I'm going to have to look this up. Shirley, thanks for the heads up on that, and I'll go off on that when I have firsthand information, but I appreciate the tip. Bill, in St. Helens, Oregon, you wanted to talk about Keystone?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm trying to read through the State Department report. It's pretty massive. I read the executive summary. People are saying somebody did the study. Well, Environmental Resources Management, ERM, did the study. Now, from here on, I'll read you verbatim just a couple quick things. From ERM's website, the key sectors we serve include oil and gas, mining, power, and manufacturing, chemical, and pharmaceutical. From the Department of State executive summary, ERM was selected pursuant to the department's interim guidance on the selection of independent third-party contractors. Last line from the DOS, a third-party contractor is a contractor that is selected by, chosen by, and working under the direction of a federal agency, but that is being paid by the applicant. There you go.
So ERM, the company that did the study for the State Department, was paid for by TransCanada?
Whoever's requested the study before, whoever required the environmental study.
I thought the State Department requested the study.
Well, it was paid for. It said it's paid for by the applicant.
Right. So what you need to know is who was the applicant, Bill, and do you know that?
I do not know that.
Okay. Well, that's the thing we need to find out. When you know that, given that you're digging into this right now and I'm on the air, if you can find out, give us a shout back, okay?
Okay.
Or maybe somebody who knows will call in. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Arlene in Redmond, because, the old follow the money, right? Arlene in Redmond, Oregon. Hey, Arlene, what's up?
Oh, I'll tell you, I've been watching another channel,
And
they are pushing the pipeline like you wouldn't believe. And one of the arguments is there will be less spills. And the other argument is it will make us oil independent.
Right.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Well, first, it'll make us oil dependent on
so much influence.
Yeah. It's a pretty sad day. There won't be fewer spills if we just stop altogether with this stuff and start, instead of subsidizing, as the president said in a speech just a week and a half ago, we're subsidizing the oil industry to the tune of $3 or $4 billion a year. If we put that money into wind and solar tomorrow and hydrogen and geothermal and biomass and wave power, and I mean, there's so many ways to generate electricity. To generate power and frankly, next year, one of the Japanese manufacturers is going to be shipping the first hydrogen powered car. I mean, it's like we could be so far ahead of the curve if we stopped throwing our money, our resources, our effort, and our time into these 19th century energy sources that are being promoted by and benefiting to exclusively of, some very, very large and wealthy families and transnational corporations. It's just crazy. They're saying, hey, we got trillions of dollars sitting in the ground. We get to get it out. No, you don't get to get it out. It'll kill the planet when you get it out. Jim, in that city I can't pronounce again, listening to WBAI.
The short-term memory's gone. It's Patchogue.
Patchogue. Thank you, Jim. Yes, the short-term memory went. Back when I was a teenager, I should have just said no. That's what. Yeah. Anyway, what's up?
I got around today, and somebody mentioned to me something about a bunch of destroyers or naval ships that were in a logjam at Norfolk. And they went to the president and said, so as soon as I heard what they went to the president and said, I'm like, this is one of these another stories from the internet. But they were worried about a Pearl Harbor situation. And I'm like, okay, well, if you're worried about a Pearl Harbor situation, then why are you broadcasting the problem to begin with?
Right. Yeah. So you're saying that the conservatives who were promoting this meme are basically saying, hey, terrorists, over here.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, amazing.
And so I don't know, maybe they were all due for dry dock or for arrest, and it just scheduling made a whole, line of these gone.
Yeah, beyond that, Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor was a very, very unique situation. It was, we had just blockaded the Straits of, what was it, the Straits of Hormuz, or was this, no, it was the Straits, that's in the Middle East. It was the Straits of... I'm forgetting the name of it. I've sailed through there, actually. Louise and I have. There's a bunch of pirates there. It's off the coast of Indonesia. But in any case, we had barricaded it, and that was the oil line from the Straits of Hormuz, from the Middle East down to Japan, and the Japanese were responding. And, we provoked a response, and the response was to attack Pearl Harbor. There's still a debate to this day about, what we knew and how we knew they would respond and all that kind of thing. But it's just... Yeah, this is bizarre. Jim, thanks for the call. Frank, thanks for listening to BAI. Frank in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on AM 950. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Yeah, hello, Tom. I just wanted to mention that perhaps something you could take a look at is the Panama Canal expansion.
Well, that's been going on down there. Yeah, that's been going on for almost...
It's connected.
Now, it's been going on for almost two decades, and I don't think that has anything to do with the pipeline. I mean, we have become a country that is so heavily indebted is the wrong word, dependent on foreign imports of manufactured goods that if they can expand the Panama Canal so that you can get Chinese goods more easily to the East Coast rather than just to the West Coast of the United States, and we can import things directly into there, it's just, it's much cheaper for Walmart kind of thing, But on the other hand, we're also the world's leading exporter of refined petroleum products. That was I don't know if we're the world's leading export, but that is our leading export. The number one thing that we exported in 2012, the last year for which I've seen statistics, the number one thing that was exported from the United States was refined petroleum products, which is why gas prices are as high as they are here. We find this stuff and we sell it to other countries where gas prices are even higher, in large part because they have gasoline taxes that are higher, but whatever. So it works both ways. If that canal is wider and the Keystone Pipeline goes through and then we start exporting through it to, exporting gasoline and diesel fuel to China, that works to the benefit of the Koch brothers and the other companies and people who are, running refineries down in the Gulf Coast. But it's not, that's not the reason that they began the process, 10, 15, 20, 15 or 20 years ago that they began the design work and the planning on the expanded Panama Canal. But your point is well made, Frank. Thanks a lot for the call. Jeremy in Townsend, Tennessee. Hey, Jeremy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yes, one of my primary questions is I want to talk about right-to-work laws.
You mean right to work for less?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, those things.
Yeah.
The
Taft-Hartley laws.
One thing that really bugs me about them is the thing is I can actually kind of support one portion of it, the concept of not having closed union shops, I guess because I am just a hint libertarian. But what really gets under my skin is the whole concept that it lets the, what is it, oh, not, the anti-union members in the union mooch off the union dues.
Right. Yeah. And that's why Taft-Hartley was passed. It was passed to destroy unions. Here's a frame that's rarely used that really should be used all the time. A corporation goes to the government and says, we want a whole bunch of benefits from you. We want special tax advantages. We want limitations of liability. We want all kinds of legal and political and economic benefits from you by virtue of incorporating. And the government says, okay, fine, you're a corporation. Everybody who works for that corporation, everybody in that corporation has to operate within the parameters of the corporate charter. Okay? You don't have a right to to be free of the corporate charter. You can't say that the marketing division is different from the manufacturing division and operates under different rules and has a different tax code. So all labor is saying is we are a, you know, we are the people who are working for the corporation. We would like to have a democracy in the workplace, and we would like to be represented by ourselves, by majority rules, by democracy. And what Right to Work for Less does is say, no, we can fracture that union, but you're not going to fracture the corporation. You know, there's been no attempts to pass laws to fracture corporations. And because it doesn't make any sense, just like it doesn't make any sense to fracture unions. But that, which is why Taft-Hartley and the whole Right to Work for Less thing is pure and simple, a naked attempt to destroy democracy in the workplace so that workplaces can be more like kingdoms, more like fiefdoms, more like little petty dictatorships. Jeremy, thanks for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's really interesting. In the last hour, we had Charlie Crist sitting here talking about how Rick Scott committed the greatest felony of his time and got to be gone. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jesse, listening on WBAI in Long Branch, New Jersey. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind?
How you doing? I've been seeing on the internet some news stories, Progressive News, that a lot of bankers have been committing suicide lately.
Yeah, three in the last week.
Yes, and
one financial reporter has gone missing. He's vanished.
Really? I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah.
I've also been seeing many economists talking about the economy, the United States economy may collapse within the next 2 months. I was wondering if you could have any information on that.
I just published in November a book titled The Crash of 2016. So I have an opinion on this issue. Yes, basically what happens in the United States, what happens around the world, frankly, but you know, I focused on American history in the book and in the research I did for the book, is that roughly every 60 years, we have what I call a great forgetting. We, you know, we go through a horrible experience. We make a horrible mistake, economic and political mistake. We have, as the result of this, an economic crash and typically a war that follows it. And then out of that, we learn some lessons and we say, okay, we're going to put into place some rules so that we don't experience this again. And that holds for about 60 years. And then the people who were, you know, in their 20s and 30s and maybe even teens, old enough to be politically conscious, when the crash happened and the mistakes were made, 60 years later, they're in their 80s, 90s, 100s. They're dying and dead. Or if they're not dead, they're old folks, nobody's listening to them, right? So we have a great forgetting, and a new generation comes along that has no recollection of those stupid mistakes that have been made 60 years earlier. And for the next 20 years, they make the exact same mistakes. And they do them on steroids. And the result of that is that you have a crash followed by a war. So every 80 years, we have a bubble, which then typically fueled by tax cuts, as in 1920, 1921, when Harding came into office and dropped the top tax rate from 91% down to 25%. You have a bubble, which led to the Roaring Twenties, followed by a bust, 1929, followed by a war, World War II. We saw it 80 years ago. From now, back in the 1930s, 80 years before that was the great crash of 1856, which led to the Civil War. 80 years before that was the great crash of 1769, 1770, which led to the American Revolution. There was a crash and a war 80 years before that. There was a crash and a war 80 years before that. We call it the War of the Roses. And you can track this all the way back into British history, even. And I think that we are in one of those cycles, number one. And that's just kind of the cyclical view of history. And number two, the mistakes that we made were the same stupid mistakes we made in the 1920s. And the biggest parts of them were paid for, basically, by Ken Lay of Enron fame, with Wendy Graham, who was on his board of directors and who used to be in charge of the commodity futures trading regulatory agency in the federal government. And that was her husband, Phil, who was the Republican senator from Texas, pushed through two pieces of legislation before he left office at the end of the Clinton administration. And in 1999 and 2000, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act and the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Bill, which ended Glass-Steagall. And these two pieces of legislation in 1999 and 2000 set up the crash of 2008 And we have not closed those holes. We have not closed those windows. We have not rebuilt the infrastructure, the regulatory infrastructure that we had to prevent the crash. And so that crash is still going on. We are still in the midst of the crash of the 2008. And it's just a question of when the next shoe is going to fall. Jesse, thank you for the call. Now, Jesse asked the question just a minute ago, you know, is there going to be a crash in the next 2 months? I mean, he's been reading these things on the Internet, and there's and they're on the right and on the left. You got people with their hair on fire about the economy and with good reason. And it's international, by the way, because as Paul Krugman pointed out in a brilliant column a week or so ago in The New York Times, back in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, again, you know, Reaganomics in that era. We deregulated the flow of money between countries. So this financialization went international. And, you know, a bunch of people jumped into that and started just manipulating currencies and making a fortune while crashing companies. I mean, this is one of the ways George Soros, he comes right out and talks about it, you know, basically bankrupting Thailand, as I recall, or maybe it was Taiwan. But I was in Thailand when it was booming, and I was in the early 80s, and I was in Thailand later when it had busted. And in fact, Louise and I were there with the kids the week that there was a revolution. They were stacking bodies in the lobby of our hotel the day after we flew out of the country in the Sheraton Hotel in downtown Bangkok. But we had been down there visiting the Klong Toi slum, which is a whole other story. But in any case, those currencies, you know, they got deregulated. Banking got deregulated. All these things have happened. You know, we're making these stupid mistakes. You know, you get a generation of stupid mistakes, and then you get this disaster. So anyhow, he said 2 months. Is it going to happen in 2 months? Here's my response to that. I titled the book The Crash of 2016 because what President Obama and his administration is doing right now is essentially the same thing that George Bush was doing through from maybe 2004 forward. It became apparent in 2004, 2005 that the United States was heading for a really serious recession and maybe even a crash. And it became obvious in the middle of 2006. And I was talking about it on the radio on this program when we had, and it was just a serendipitous coincidence that in 2006, I was reading a book that was published back in the 40s that was a history, a definitive history of the Great Depression and what led up to it. And it was telling this whole story about in 1926, there was from 1921 to 1926, there had been so much hot money flooding into the real estate market and the stock market, too, as a result of this huge tax cut that Warren Harding put into place, that they called it those intermittent years. They called them the Coolidge prosperity. Right. It was just like this giant bubble. That during the Hoover administration, the bubble burst. But in 1926, housing starts dropped more than 30% in one quarter. And the price of real estate down in Florida, from Florida all the way up to New York City and all the way across to California, but particularly in Florida, the price of real estate had been almost doubling every year in 24, 25, and 26. And then in 26, housing starts dropped by about a 30% drop in the end of 1926. And that presaged, and that housing start drop continued into 1927, and that presaged the Great Crash. And so I'm reading this book, and I read an article in the Financial Times about how, you know, the quarterly housing starts numbers had just come out. This was in 2006, and you can go back and look at it. The last quarter of 2006, as I recall, it might have been the third quarter, but whichever one it was, they dropped almost 34%. It was an almost mirror image of 1926. And so I went on the air and said, you know, if I was in the stock market, and I was in a small way, I mean, I'm not a wealthy investor by any means, but, you know, you get a little bit of retirement money. I said, if I'm in the stock market, I'm selling everything. I'm turning it all into cash. And people for the next 2 years were calling into this show. And those of you who've been long-term listeners, you know this story. Calling in going, hey, Hartman, the stock market just went up another 300 points. I just made another, you know, $400 on my GE stock. How about you? And I'm going, I'm sitting on cash. You know, not a lot, but I'm sitting on, you know. And, you know, I've just, for 2 years, almost 2 years, it was about a year and a half. And then the bottom fell out of the stock market. And then people started calling going, hey, you know, I got out of the market when you suggested, and I missed that peak. I missed that top 3,000 points, but thank God I did, because the market is now at 5,600 or whatever it was, you know, when it was really in the tank. So I'm back in cash, and I'm no investment advisor, and I don't, you know, I'm not telling you to follow my investment advice, because I'm a lousy investor. I've never made money investing. I don't think people should have to make money investing. I think this whole 401k IRA scam that Ronald Reagan sold us to do away with pensions so that we would all suddenly have to start paying attention to the stock market and really caring about it and watching TV shows and reading books and learning what these different things are. Hey, do you know what VXX is? And you know, how's your GE stock doing today? All of this stuff was just to get us to identify with the billionaires, to get us to think that the stock market was some sacred thing, that it was some barometer that we should care about. Frankly, we shouldn't give a rat's patootie about the stock market. The stock market, you know, the 80% of the stocks in the United States are held by very, very wealthy people or banks, you know, or pension or, you know, trust funds. So it shouldn't be an issue for us. But it is, because so many people have 401ks and IRAs, and they put money in stocks in them. And so now we get to get scammed, excuse me, by the scam artists on Wall Street and the banksters and the hustlers, you know, thanks to Ronald Reagan. But anyhow, I'm seeing the Obama administration do the same thing the Bush administration did, which is try to blow that bubble as hard as you can until after the next presidential election so that you and your party don't get blamed for the crash. And it didn't work for George Bush. He mistimed it by about 9 months. And I don't know if it's going to work for President Obama or not. I don't know if he can hold this thing off until November or December of 2016 or if it's going to go next week. I don't have any clue. You'd have to have a crystal ball or be a whole lot better at charting and trading and understanding cycles of markets and all that kind of. I am not knowledgeable in that area. But what I do know is that the infrastructure, the regulatory infrastructure, is not in place. We have not been enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. We have not been regulating the banksters. We haven't even been doing what Ronald Reagan did with the SNLs. He nationalized all of the SNLs and sent, you know, 1,000 people to trial and 600 people to prison over the SNL crisis. I mean, we should be doing that right now with people on Wall Street. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, all the news and information you're not going to hear on the corporate-owned news media. Plus, it's Anything Goes Friday, your chance to choose a topic. Bernie was with us yesterday, so tomorrow it's going to be 3 hours of your calls. We got a lot of stuff to talk about, too. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. It's not a spectator sport. Tag your... Get out there and
occupy. You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.